It was the summer of 1984. I was on a little piece of land on the plains of southern Alberta in Canada, and I was listening to a drumbeat and a song. Actually, I'd been listening to many a drumbeat and a song, and I was watching people do a dance. I was there at the powwow for the Blackfoot Nation in the part of the nation that they were in southern Alberta. It was their annual powwow. It was their annual gathering. Every song seemed to build in strength and power with the drum beat and the singing, and people were dancing dances that they had known since before they could even walk. But this dance was a little bit different, because all the other dances had the entire community dancing together, going around and around in a circle, graciously inviting me to become a part of it, although they were laughing at the way in which I danced, because I can't dance to begin with, much less dance a dance that I have no idea how to dance. But they were gracious. But on this dance, there were only about eight people. Eight young people. These eight young people, coincidentally, were the eight young people that the next morning would be going with me on a backpacking trip into the Kananaskis Wilderness area in the Canadian Rockies. In that backpacking trip, part of what we were trying to do was to take the children who were such urbanized children and put them in the midst of God's stunning and amazing creation and allow them a chance to begin to experience the world in a very different way from the very fast world in which they lived. These children were all part of a group home that was for those native children in southern Alberta. They were perhaps the most fragile members of a community that was already fragile, as is the case with so many tribal communities, whether in Canada or here in the U.S., rampant unemployment, rampant alcoholism, rampant poverty, and here were these young people who got into deeper and deeper trouble. They were the most fragile of a fragile community, and they were standing there all by themselves, doing a dance, until about a minute or so in, a couple people came to join them. First it was friends, then it was family members, some of them being family members that they had struggled and broken apart from, but now the family members were dancing with them. And as time built, eventually those young people were 100% surrounded by the community in which they had been brought up. They were surrounded by the community, and they were dancing together in a sense of rhythm and balance that I had never seen before. And the point of it was explained to me, this was the honor dance. This was the dance in which they were honoring these young people and telling them and wishing them well and extending their spirit to them so that when they went out the next day into that which would be scary to them, when they went out the next day and for the next 10 days, they would know that the community went with them, that they were not alone by any means, that they could do anything because their community was with them. And I've thought about that honor dance for so many times since that time in the summer of 1984 when I was privileged to be able to witness that. And I've thought about the lessons that are there of all that we can do when we recognize that we are in fact one together, and that we are able to work together. 49 years ago, on April 22nd, the first Earth Day happened in the United States, 1970. The years that ticked off after 1970 were phenomenal years in which we have seen an amazing amount of working together. In 1970, the Environmental Protection Agency was established. Before that, there had not been such a thing as an Environmental Protection Agency. There had not been an intent from a governmental perspective, from a nation's perspective, to look at the need to protect the environment. That was a time, if you may remember, when rivers were on fire, when the skies were so filled with smog that in Los Angeles and New York City and other places, you could barely see in front of you. In 1970, the Environmental Protection Agency comes into being. In 1970, the same year as the first Earth Day, the Clean Air Act is passed. In the 49 years that have followed since then, 71% of key pollutants have been taken out of the atmosphere. The cars and trucks that we are driving now are 99% cleaner than they were in 1970. In 1972, the National Marine Sanctuaries Act was established, protecting marine areas as we protect our national parks. Worldwide, 25 million square kilometers have been protected through the National Marine Protection Act and one similar. 1.5 million kilometers of that is right here in Hawaii in the largest marine preserve, Papahanaumokuakea. In 1973, the Endangered Species Act was passed, and people began to work together to try and bring back species from the brink of extinction, one of them being the nene goose that now has been delisted off of the almost extinct list. In 1974, as part of that 1973 decision of the Endangered Species Act, we banned DDT, which is what brought the bald eagle back from this close to extinction. A number of years later, not only the U.S., but many nations together worked together to ban chlorofluorocarbons or something like that, CFCs. The scientist in me does not want to pronounce those words. And because of that, this massive hole in the ozone that was developing as a result of that began to shrink, and there has been a 98% decrease in ozone-depleting emissions. And in 2016, just a few years ago, 197 countries signed together the Paris Climate Accord. It's a lot that has happened in 49 years because, like that honor dance, people chose to work together. And yet, despite those strides, here's some of the other realities of those 49 years. In those 49 years, the population of our world has more than doubled, from 3.7 billion in 1970 to 7.7 billion now. The parts of carbon dioxide per million that exist in our atmosphere, which is what is the primary cause of climate change, global warming, has risen from 325, where it was still safe, in 1970 to 412 parts per million and climbing right now. We have emitted since 1970 1.2 trillion tons of CO2 into the atmosphere. We, now the 7.7 billion people, are consuming 21% more carbon per person than was being done in 1970, when there were only 3.7 billion people. We have increased the number of miles that are average driven per person worldwide by 184%. We have increased the air travel by 495%. We have seen our diets change with a 60% increase in meat consumption. And though we have seen the rates of folks that are dealing with hunger issues actually decrease over those years, now, 3 out of 10 people worldwide are dealing with obesity because of the way in which we have shifted our habits, our eating habits, and most of those are carbon-centered. We've produced 15 times more plastic. 150 million tons of plastic exist in the ocean right now. Many of those coming from the 7 million plastic bottles that are produced every minute in the United States for one form or another of consumption, of which only 9% will be recycled. And the species that share this planet with us have struggled. 50% of the coral has been lost. 90% of all seafood stocks are now fully fished or overfished. Wild animal populations dropped by 38%. Over 170 animals have gone extinct in those 50 years, a rate never seen before. Such a stark contrast from the things of which we can look to in 49 years and see great success and those that have been great failures. And what is the primary thing that changes those two things? The great successes have come when folks have recognized that we are in this together and we work together. And the failures have come when we do it all on our own and only look out for the needs of ourselves. Gus Speth, who was the former dean at the Yale School of Forestry, wrote these words. I used to think the top environmental problems were biodiversity loss, ecosystem collapse, and climate change. I thought that with 30 years of good science, we could address these problems. But I was wrong. The top environmental problems, he said, are selfishness, greed, and apathy. And to deal with those, we need a spiritual and cultural transformation, and we scientists don't know how to do that. A spiritual and cultural transformation in order to deal with selfishness, greed, and apathy. I disagree with him. We do know how to do this. I don't disagree with his assessment. I only disagree with the fact that he says know how to do this. Scientists even know how to do this. And it doesn't come from having Hallmark cards that say Happy Earth Day one day out of 365 days of the year. It comes, in many ways, if we are brave enough and bold enough to return to the very sacred text that defines so many of our lives. The Earth Day that I would like us to return to is not the Earth Day of 1970. The Earth Day that I would like us to return to is that very first Earth Day that we have talked about within the biblical story. When Michael reads to us from Psalm 33, we read these words, God's faithful love fills the entire earth. The skies are made by God's word, the starry multitude by the breath of God's mouth. God gathers together the ocean waters. God puts the deep seas together. All the earth honors our gods. All the earth's inhabitants stand in God because, and I love this line, when God spoke, it happened. So from the psalmist's perspective on that very first Earth Day, and we're not going to get into whether that first Earth Day is 13.7 billion years ago, which I would be happy to assume is the case. For whatever it is, what the psalmist speaks about is the fact that God is present in the creation of all that is around here and speaks, and it happens in love. Now, we are familiar with the creation story that we find in the first chapter of Genesis. And if you've been listening to me, you know that I love the first chapter of Genesis. You know that I love that the way that the story is unfolded is that humankind is created as a part of, not apart from, the rest of the creation. You know that I love the fact that it ends with God looking out on everything and saying it is good and it is blessed. But there is another creation story as well. It's the creation story that Michael was reading for us from chapter 2. It's a little bit different take on the first Earth Day, as you might call it. It's a little bit different take, and the problem with chapter 2 is that we have been conditioned to not listen to any of that earth stuff and go right to Adam and Eve and the serpent and go right to all the interpretations of really bad theology that have been passed down to us for a couple of thousand years. And so we have this story where Eve is created out of Adam's rib. And somehow in a patriarchal world, we have decided that that means that therefore women are inferior to men and are subjugated to men. And then we have the story that is that Augustine and others jumped on top of and said, and the serpent speaks to Eve and Eve eats the apple and offers it to Adam. Adam eats just as much of the apple as Eve does, but somehow the women are the evil ones. Because she was the one that was tempted and then becomes the temptress. And then the theology goes on with Augustine to say, and this is the original sin, and we are in deep kimchi from that point forward. And that's the way we read Genesis chapter 2. But the truth of the matter is, so much has been lost. And that's why when I gave Michael the scripture to read, I took out almost all of that, so that we could hear the rest of it. Because just like in Genesis 1, what we read in the very beginning of Genesis chapter 2 is that everything here on spaceship Earth that we are a part of emerges from God's creative energies. It is from God that all of this emerges. It is from God that, in fact, it is God's presence that is all that has been created. As the psalmist says, faithful love fills the earth. And then in the most marvelous of stories, God reaches down into the bare earth, known in Hebrew as Adama, and scoops it up and forms it into a man known as Adam. So the earth and the man are created of exactly the same substance. 8 weeks ago, when we were gathered together for Ash Wednesday, we said, dust we are, and to dust we shall return. Ashes we are, to ashes we shall return. It is that very dust that we are created from. And so we are a part of the earth, and it is even found in the words Adama and Adam. And then God breathes into this that God has created, and it comes alive. So each one of us following in that story is of the earth and of God. And if that's not enough, God then decides to create this place of beauty and abundance. Look at what is on our table here. To create a garden of beauty and abundance, and puts the human, that very first human, into that place and gives one very simple piece of instruction. Take care of it and look after it. And in the Hebrew, it basically means take care of it, and take care of it to serve it. To serve it. It is not just there for you. Serve it as if you care and you love for it. And then the story continues on and says, God says, I don't want this poor human being to be all alone. We are created to be in community. So begins to create in the very same way. Takes from the earth, forms a shape, blows into it, and all the animals, all the birds, all the fish, everything that is living is created in this way. And what we discover is just like ourselves, that which God has created comes from the earth, comes from the breath of God, but in fact is not quite like us. Still our kin. If you were to sit around the dinner table with my family, you would know that just because we share the same blood, we are very, very different. So it is that just because we share the same earth and the very same breath of God, we are kin, but different from what God has created. And then God says, but I will make a perfect complement. I will make a helper, a partner that is a perfect complement that completes this first human being. And it is from there that Eve is created. It is not as something that is inferior or anything else. It is that which is created to complete. So if what we need is a spiritual and cultural transformation to change the way that we get away from that greed and that apathy and all of that, what about reorienting our hearts and our spirits and our awareness so that we once again recognize that God is present in everything that we see around us? So when you walk past Kazooie, where is Kazooie? There she is. When you walk past Kazooie, oh, she's giving it away. She gave it to Elaine. The pikakele that Elaine is wearing or that Richard is wearing, and you walk past that and you smell that beautiful scent that comes from that pikake, remember, that is a sign God is walking in that garden with you. That very fragrance is a sign that God is walking in that garden. When you go out tonight and you see that first star appear in the sky, can we not see that as God just blinking at us and saying, I'm here? When we take the hand of a neighbor and we take the hand of the neighbor, can we not remember that God is present to us in human form when that hand is reached out to us? Can we not choose to also recognize that the differences in our human community are not differences of division, but those of completion? Whether it be skin color or gender orientation or sexual identity, whatever it is, these differences are not created to divide us. These differences are created to complete us. They make each of us the perfect pairing with one another. The divisions that are created are not there, or the differences are not to divide, but to complete. Can we not look around and reorient ourselves to see that all that God has created is indeed our kin? So that when we are developing a piece of land, can we not be aware of the homes for some of the animals that will be lost, and how do we then mitigate against that? Does it not teach us something about how we eat? We cannot consume food without killing something, whether it be a plant or whether it be an animal, but must it be needless and cruel? Can it not be done in a way in which we honor the very spirit of that which has been created, knowing that we too will one day return to the ground, and may it be done in a way that is humane and not cruel for ourselves? Can we not be a people to work and keep the land as if it is ours to serve rather than it is ours to take? Our Hawaiian ancestors understood that every drop of water that fell at the top of the ko'olau's was a drop that needed to be managed as it worked its way down ultimately to the ocean. So concerned were they of even the drop of water, knowing that in that water is life. And the food plants, whether they be the kalo, the u'ala, the ulu, all the different food plants, they understood that they had a responsibility to care for those plants because those plants would in turn be caring for them. Robin Wall Kimmerer, who wrote the book Braided Sweetgrass, talks about the honorable harvest, and it is a complete reflection of that which we read in Genesis chapter 2 of how we are to care for, to serve the land. The honorable harvest is something of to take only what is given, to use it well, to be grateful for the gift, and to reciprocate the gift. So for all the plants that we grow, to take what we need, to use it well, to honor it, and care for the land so that when those plants are ready to grow again, they are able to grow and thrive. If we are going to have, as Gus Speth says we can't do, a spiritual and cultural transformation, if we are going to have an honor dance like those young people had, where we recognize that we are indeed all one, but it is not just the community of humans, but it is the community of the creation, it will be quite personal. It will affect what I eat, what I wear, how I travel, how I support myself, how I take care of my ohana, when and who I gather with, how I pray, how I am aware. It will affect all of those personal decisions in my life. But that is how we are called to be from the very first words that come to us from our sacred texts, that come to us through the generations, that come to us from one different spiritual tradition or another, is to take into account in our personal lives how the decisions we make impact all that God has created. And today, with the billions of people that live here, with the reality of the place of very great distress that we are in, with climate that is changing at a rate faster than anyone was going to predict, it is also political. And so you have our representatives in Congress that are putting forth things called a Green New Deal, a way to reorient our life. Then there are probably great problems with it, but the reality is not so much just saying because there's a problem, we throw it out. The reality is to recognize, excuse me, that there is a need to transform the way in which we as a community, we as a society, we as a culture operate in this economy and this world. Right now, there are young people who are suing the United States, demanding that the government act on climate change. I've mentioned this before, 21 young people between the ages of 11 and 22, claiming that the government's actions and inactions in the face of global warming violate their fundamental constitutional right to freedom from the deprivation of life, liberty, and poverty. The young people are speaking to us. They are speaking to us and saying, we all are going to be gone soon. They will not. This planet that God has given to us, this creation that we are a part of, is ours to be shared with one another and with all that has been created. And it is our responsibility to make sure that the ways that govern us as a people match that reality. And they are calling out to us from age 11. There are Christian activists right now who have locked themselves to gates and to trucks and all sorts of other places in London right now, stopping traffic so as to make sure that attention is paid in Parliament to the issues of climate change. There are young people sitting outside the doors of every parliament in Europe demanding that people pay attention. And they are coming at it from a variety of places, but they are in many ways coming at it from a place of faith. Melody Zhang, She is the co-chair of the Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. Evangelicals is not a word that we talk a lot about here at Church of the Crossroads. We sometimes, if we say evangelical, we think about, oh, it's those folks, those kinds of Christians over there. Well, those kinds of Christians over there, those evangelicals, those young evangelicals for climate change, are speaking truth that we need to be hearing. And just this month, testifying at the House Subcommittee on the Climate Crisis, she said the following: as a Christian, 22 years old, I believe God calls us to a total and radical reimagination and transformation of our relationship with others and the earth. We yearn toward a future vision of complete reconciliation for all of God's created order. To my fellow believers in the room, we live in the era of the resurrected Christ. So then let us practice resurrection. We can begin to practice the cultivation of wholeness in our communities by addressing the climate crisis faithfully and with the full attention it demands of us. It is a tangible fulfillment of the commandment to love our neighbors as ourselves. That is my prayer for you. And so speaks the wisdom of a 22-year-old person of faith speaking to us. It is not about everyday Earth Day. It is not about having the best Earth Day celebration. It is not about any of those things. It is about the transformation that needs to happen within ourselves as people of faith, as we approach this creation that God has blessed us to be a part of, and we approach it and understand that all that God has created, God is present in, and we approach it in such a way that we understand that all that God has created is indeed our kin, of the very same substance that each of us, and we approach it with the very first and most simple of commandments: care for it all as if you are there to serve it. That is our call this day and every day. Amen.